Few books balance a father's love and his heavy hands like that of The Beautiful Struggle. We're talking with the patriarch of Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, The Beautiful Struggle, on this edition of Frank Relationships.
You're listening to Frank Relationships with Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Yeah, as always, those are my babies. Thanks for getting Daddy started today. Mwah! Welcome to Frank Relationships, where we provide a candid, fresh, and frank look into relationships with goals of acceptance, respect, and flexibility. I'm Frank Love, and you can find me, my blog, and my various social media incarnations at franklove.com. You can also find me on ABC's Good Morning Washington most Friday mornings during the 9 o'clock hour. If you're listening to the show on Blog Talk Radio, please follow us. And if via iTunes, please subscribe so that you can effortlessly get each week's show each week. Also, if you're enjoying the show, and of course you are, please share it with your family and friends on your favorite social media platform. We're always looking for new social media friends, so please help us help our communities by spreading the word about the show. Greetings to my co-host, Nancy Goldring.
Hi, Frank.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great, how are you?
Great, the consummate generalist is in the house.
Indeed.
We're also joined by today's visiting co-host, Kiwe Madyun. Greetings, Brother Kiwe.
Peace, brother, how are you?
I'm great. Who are you and what do you do when you're not co-hosting?
Well, such an interesting question that you always have to find how to answer it when it's asked in a particular environment. So today I would make that statement by saying, first of all, I'm a father along with a grandfather. I'm a husband. I'm an educator. I'm a trainer. You know, and on top of all of that, I'm well-traveled. And I am familiar with the planet that we are on.
Very good.
Who you think you're going to get along with best today, me or Nancy?
Well, you and I have never gotten along, so I mean, Nancy automatically comes
in
thank first
you,
place.
Sir.
So
thank
all right,
you.
All right, all right. Get him out of here.
And plus, if you take a look at you versus Nancy, there's no contest.
I'm not saying a word.
As is the case this week with Brother Kiwe, there's a visiting guest host chair available each week here in the studio. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area or traveling to the D.C. area and want to join us in the studio on a given Thursday morning, email me at frank@franklove.com and let me know. It is a tremendous honor to host today's guest. Not only is he a friend of my father's, he's a leader in the field of independent publishers as the founder of Black Classic Press, which is a publishing company devoted to publishing obscure and significant works by and about people of African descent. And he is the founder of BCP Digital Printing, which produces books and documents using digital print technology. And not only is he the head of one of the few Black-owned publishers in the United States, he is also the patriarch in the memoir by Ta-Nehisi Coates, The Beautiful Struggle. So, if you, like me, want to know his thoughts on a litany of authors like James Baldwin and Richard Wright, what passionate fatherhood is, and how he collaborated with his son to create one of the most respected and talked about books on race of our time, or at least in some time, then stay tuned as your Frank Relationship team talks with father, husband, and publisher, Paul Coates. Welcome to the show, Brother Coates.
Thank you, brother. Thank you, Brother Frank. Glad to be here. Let me add that to it, okay?
Thank
Glad
you.
Glad to be here this morning.
Before we get too deep into your interview, I'm going to check in and do our segment on what's going on in the world of relationships. You got anything for me, Nancy? Okay. All right.
I just want to say I have something, but I'm going to defer to you.
I appreciate a little deference. Thank you. Okay, I got something.
Okay.
There's a guy by the name of, an athlete by the name of Adam LaRoche, I believe his name is.
Okay.
He's a former Washington Nationals first baseman, and he's a recent Chicago White Sox player. And he recently retired despite having a $13 million a year contract. When the team informed him that they wanted him to limit his son's clubhouse appearances. So his son used to come to the ballpark with him all the time.
Okay.
Like every minute of the day where his dad was there, his son was there.
Okay.
And I think he went to all of his games, traveled with him to his games. He and his wife, this player and his wife, had a tutor work with him on the road. But the management of the White Sox informed him that they wanted to limit the son's time with him.
Hmm.
And he said,
"No way.
Take care." He
wow.
said, "I'm out of here."
Wow. Wow.
I mean, so what are your thoughts on giving up $13 million a year so that your son can be with you?
Wow. Well, evidently he didn't need the money.
Oh, okay.
He clearly didn't need the money. He clearly had made enough money to take care of his family, and he had an idea about the value of his son being able to track his steps through life mm-hmm. in his development into manhood. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing I can think of. Mm. And he's pretty serious about it.
Brother Coates?
Yeah, you know, I followed that in the news. And it's one of those things. I don't know the story that's under the story.
Yeah.
You know, I know the story that's reported.
Right.
Yeah, I know the story that's reported. And on commenting on what's reported, it does seem like a matter of understanding value to money mm-hmm. and an understanding of making a choice of what's important in life to him mm-hmm. and giving that to his son, not only to his son, but literally to the world as a value lesson or
yes.
a lesson in values, mm-hmm. you know, that money is not the determinant,
yeah.
you know, or at least it's not the long-term determinant or the final determinant, mm-hmm. you know, and sometimes people have to do things for money as survival. But as Nancy was saying, perhaps he has enough money that he doesn't have to exist on the survival level. But I tend to think even if he did, his values would call this into being in a way mm-hmm. that it would act out and he would still make a decision that was favorable to his kids and those values, mm-hmm. you know?
It's worth noting that he, in this article that I was reading, that he said he thought this was his last year playing.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been in the league for, I think, over 10 years.
Okay.
So it wasn't like it was his first year, which $13 million would be. $13 million is different
yeah.
in your first year.
Than it is in your final year.
Yes. Yeah. yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
Did they say how old the boy is?
I saw a picture of him. He looked to be 11, 12, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, in hearing that story, the first thing that came to mind was Barry Bonds.
Mm-hmm. And his father.
Right.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
Willie Mays,
mm-hmm.
because Barry spent a lot of time in the locker room from the time of three,
mm-hmm.
and look what he was able to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that came to mind is hoping that, you know, you said son, with a man of, I'm assuming he's of African descent.
No, he's not.
He's not. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, with someone with that type of dedication to family, I would hope he would have many more sons.
Yeah.
I didn't get that impression from the article, but you know, I mean, well, who knows what the story under the story is? I like that, Brother Coates. I'm gonna keep that. The story under the story. there's also a new book called. By Daya Smith, and it's called Soft is the New Power. And the subtitle is Embracing Your Feminine Edge to Win in Love and Life. And I heard her in an interview recently, and she's really talking about how women get the opportunity to not be so in your face with their men or to just simply be softer and an effort to get whatever it is they want or would it, to get to whatever goal they wish to achieve. You got anything on that, Nancy, as the woman in the house?
I feel that the soft approach, especially as a woman engaging men, is much more effective for me than if I kind of try to take the masculine with the man. And that is actually, I almost want to call it a skill that I've learned to develop. And certainly in today's culture where men, where women are looking for equality and power, sometimes
a certain type of power,
sometimes we come off with a certain level of dominance and almost masculinity in our approach to dealing with certain issues that isn't necessarily necessary.
Yeah.
And I feel, you know, I definitely don't want it to feel like taking the soft approach is a form of manipulation, because it really is not. And it has taken a tremendous amount of inner, I almost want to call it intestinal fortitude and patience with myself. Because taking the soft approach isn't always what I'm actually feeling like doing. It's something I'm having to cultivate throughout the conversation, especially a complex or difficult conversation.
Brother Coates, do you prefer, this is, and the question is almost absurd because it's a loaded question. Do you prefer for your wife to come at you or to deal with you in a soft or hard approach?
Actually, I have to invert that, because I was thinking more of the question to me.
To you, to her.
Me coming. Beautiful. Me coming, not only her, but coming at people and the power of taking a quote-unquote softer approach to people, especially if it's a legitimate approach. You know, if I'm actually in the space softness, I think about listening. You know, I think about listening, being in a position to actually hear what's being said and what's not being said in the conversation. That's softer to me. It's also a very powerful place, because you get to understand. You get to understand what the person is saying, and you're getting at the same time an opportunity to understand yourself. So that's a lot of power in that to me. You know?
Ironically, that is not how Ta-Nehisi describes you in his book, The Beautiful Struggle.
Here
now,
we go.
It's funny because sons, you know, sons know their dads. I mean, given Ta-Nehisi, what is he, 40 now?
He actually is 40, yeah.
Okay, so given that he's known you for 40 years, he's definitely seen you go through life and change and be whatever, you know, and he's grown. So you got two people growing at the same time. So while his perception of you and how he describes you, that was not so much soft.
you have to understand in context, I think he would describe me that way.
Really? That's great.
Oh, yeah, I think he would.
Okay.
What he's doing in The Beautiful Struggle is really looking at a period of his life, and he's really taking himself back and placing himself inside that period and looking there, as opposed to being 40 looking back.
Yes,
on it.
Yes.
So he's looking at how it appeared and how I appeared to him at that age, you see. And, and he's looking at his world, actually, from that same space. Like, he's looking at his time from 5 years old, 9 years old, 17 years old. That's the space that he's interpreting that story from. But in fact, he's written many, many times about the reserve that his father is. A lot of his reserve is in that same vein. It's a matter of listening. It's a matter of I think about it like as an art to know when you're like when you're supposed to apply the pressure.
Yes.
And not to say that I do that expertly, but that's a goal.
You're aware
of it.
That's
a goal. Yeah. To be aware of it, to notice it, is in itself an extreme amount of power. I think he would agree with that.
I got to give my quick commentary on this book. You so often, number one, I think this book is the perfect work for a young man who is between maybe 12 and 20, particularly a young black male, because it really examines a young person's view of their father at so many different levels, and an understanding of their father along a different timeline. So the book was, it's outstanding to watch this young man from describe his father from the time of before he was born. So going back to talking about you being in war, in the Vietnam War, or being a member of the Black Panthers, this is all before he was born, up until going to college. And I listened to the, what's the newest book? Between Me and the World.
The
World and Me. Mm-hmm. I listened to that months ago. So I don't remember everything about that book as well as I do this one. Mm-hmm. This one I just did this week. Mm-hmm. And it seems like one is almost a sequel to the other. So the first book takes you up until Ta-Nehisi goes to Howard University. Mm-hmm. So it goes from his father's, before he was conceived, when his dad was in the Vietnam War, all of that stuff I said, all the way up to him attending Howard University. And then the second book, much of it has to do with Howard University, and he's talking to his son about his life, and it's they go really hand in hand. It's quite a beautiful piece of a series. It's
yes.
a beautiful series.
Yes.
And not only that, God, I'm rambling. There's so much I want to say, but you often hear about abusive relationships between fathers and sons. Like that's when you talk about fathers and sons, particularly in books and on TV and the movies and stuff like that, if you have to pick a way the relationships tend to go, they're abusive more than they're not, more than they're healthy.
Yeah, they're archetypally yeah. disciplinarian.
Exactly.
Rough and tumble.
And this book, you get a feeling, you get an insight of a father that's hardcore, that for me as a black male that's a little older than Ta-Nehisi, who has a father that's a friend of Brother Coates, you can see the similarities, and I can also appreciate it to no end. The hard edge, I appreciate that in my dad. And it sounded, although Ta-Nehisi doesn't explicitly say this in the book, it sounds as though he appreciates it in his father also.
Well, you know, just to jump in, Frank, I've seen Ta-Nehisi on several Democracy Now, mm-hmm. which has led me to YouTube and listen to quite a few of his lectures and his speech. And I'm honored. I'm just awhelmed and honored to be sitting here next to his father. And as a father of three sons by birth and several nephews and grandsons, I see that discipline. And being a father, I know that there was a soft side that had to come along with that discipline when the son was in the room complaining or crying about having to, you know, take out the trash. So in meeting this brother and sitting next to this brother, and as a father, as I said, I know that there was a soft side. Mm-hmm. And that soft side was what made that discipline stick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting. Baba, that's very insightful. You know, one of the things in the book you're mainly talking about, The Beautiful Struggle, when I read it, I get a lot of times I'm laughing, right? Because, you know, as fathers, you know, you lay down the law, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. you lay down the law, and then you go in the room, especially if you're gifted to have a wife, a partner mm-hmm. with you. Mm-hmm. You go in the room and you laugh about it.
Right. <You know? laughs> I really can relate.
That's right. Yep.
You know, you actually laugh about it. Yep. You know, so you're showing, and this is one of the reasons why I'm saying he understands it now, having his own son.
Uh-huh. Right.
But he's writing from the perspective of this 14-year-old, this yes. 9-year-old. And so he's giving you that view. But he understands now that when you're laying down the law, you're doing it, you're shaking your head, son, you know, this is the way this is going to go. It's going to go my way.
Right.
You know,
it can't no go no other way.
And then you know, you hold that straight face and you really, really hold it. And then you get out of the room and you just cackle.
Right,
you
know? Right.
So it doesn't mean you're hard. You know, it doesn't mean you're hard. It means that you're consistently driving That's home right. a point. You're consistently preparing what I consider to be preparing the child or the children. In this case, Ta-Nehisi said he had five brothers, four mm-hmm. brothers, because he's fifth. At that time, there were seven children,
wow.
and so he came up like that, and they were dealt with. When you have seven children, all my children were not in the same house by the same mothers at the same time. But whenever you have seven children together, you got to dispense justice quickly.
And
you don't have time to say, well, Junior, please don't do that. You know, you say, look, if you do that again, I'm going to pop you upside your head. I
got a great quote. There was different things in this book that I really, I laughed. I laughed. He said, you deployed the strap to enlighten children and bring them into balance.
This is true.
And it worked.
This is true. But you know, like, the interesting thing that he does not get there, and it amazes me because he didn't get it in Between the World and Me either, that I always thought not so much, and so many, there's a community of people that does not believe at all in touching people, touching their children at all, you know. And so when Ta-Nehisi talks about that, he talks about it from an enlightened place, okay?
He was balanced.
Yeah. But other folks will see it as the most grievous sin to have touched your child. And people have written about it. People said, well, gosh, he abused him. He needs to be in jail. You know what I mean?
Oh, my gracious.
All this stuff. No. If I needed to go to jail for anything, the strap that Ta-Nehisi talks about, and even the use of the strap, I don't think that was a crime to me. I think the threat of it. Mm-hmm. If there's one thing that I'm, you know, like really mindful of, is you don't beat children like you can't beat children beat, but you can always say, look,
right?
Do you know where the strap is? Right. You know, you can always say that with mind.
Do you know
where this is going? Right. and inside of that, Frank, is this thing that I firmly believe. But it's very important for us to teach our children that there are consequences to everything.
Yeah.
There are rewards in life, and then there are consequences in life. And it's important that that's a part of home lesson. That's a part of being raised. And I think that's what, in my world, that's what good parents do, especially with black boys.
Yes.
Especially with black boys. Because if they don't get it at home, then it's only one other place to get it, and that's the street.
And the legal system.
And the legal system. That's it. Yeah, that's it. That's it. So, I mean, you get it one way or the other. Yeah. And if you're successful, I think, those lessons come at home.
Mm-hmm. What's your story? How'd you get into publishing?
Publishing came out of the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. It, you know, it was like when I left the Black Panther Party, I still wanted to. The large experience of the Black Panther Party for me was educating our community. Mm-hmm. I still wanted to do that. I still had a commitment that I had people in jail in Maryland when I left. As you know, Eddie Conway just was recently released from jail. That was a 44-year commitment. Mm-hmm. Wow. So I had people in jail when I left the Black Panther Party that I was still committed to, and I began working in the jails with publishing and working on the street with publishing as a way of what I always think about is combating ignorance, you know, and killing ignorance. Mm-hmm. And I always looked at books as bullets to kill that ignorance, you know. Mm-hmm. So coming out of the Panther Party, I still wanted to do that, and that's what I did. You know, I put together a bookstore initially that was to work in the prisons and on the street. Mm-hmm. On top of that was supposed to come a publishing company that would supply the bookstore, and on top of that was supposed to come a printing company. Mm-hmm. And if you look at Black Classic Press and BCP Digital today, you see that's what it is. Yeah. And we do work with people, formerly incarcerated people, quite a few of them, and have worked with them over time. So that's really where that vision comes from. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the BCP Digital printing. Is that for anybody to present you with a file and say, I'd like my book printed?
Yeah. The first thing is, I mean, we print all of the books for Black Classic Press for our books. Uh-huh. But we also support most of the independent full-time Black publishers across the country. We support them by printing their books. It's a real interesting, I'm very excited about it, and thank you for asking, because I think that's the publishing books is fine, but I think building the printing company, because there are no Black book printers. Mm-hmm. There just aren't, mm-hmm. you know, very few white ones, but there are no Black book printers. To be able to create an environment in which a black writer, first of all, conceives of a book, mm-hmm. carries it to a Black publisher, and then that Black publisher carries it to a Black printer, and then that book is in turn sold in a Black bookstore. Mm-hmm. And consumed by a Black reader. To be able to do that with a dollar is an amazing, is an amazing, amazing, amazing accomplishment in this time. And so there are those types of partnerships. We don't only publish for Black companies, of course. We publish for many, many. We publish for Pearson Education, the largest educational publisher in the country. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of other publishing. But to be able to have that resource in our community, I feel is a tremendous accomplishment. And tremendously grateful for it. Mm-hmm.
Where'd you grow up?
Philadelphia, Philly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what in Philly, or I guess you got a major stake in Baltimore. Baltimore is a big part of your world, and it has been for many years.
Yeah.
Could you speak?
I came to Baltimore right after the military in love. Mm-hmm. You know, see, that's that soft side.
Oh, boy.
Just nose wide open for my first wife, and went down there. And
that is, your first wife was Linda?
My first wife was Linda, and the three children from that marriage, two of them work with me, and two of them are in Black Classic Press and run the company pretty much now. Yeah, but my first wife was Linda.
And they're, so give me the rundown on the children, the names.
Sure. My first three children are, in fact, my son, shout out to Damani, who is Big Bill in that book, His birthday is today. So there were three children there. In the Black Panther Party, there were, I had two children born in the Black Panther Party, and then two children born after that. Mm-hmm. And so that's what that is, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a total of seven children.
Gotcha. And what was your history in the Black Panthers? Because when I hear you talk about leaving the Panthers, I don't get the impression that it was just, I'm moving on. I get the impression, basically in the book, that it wasn't an amicable split.
It was amicable in the sense that I arrived at a place. I used to run the chapter in Baltimore as the defense captain. When I went to California under Panther orders, I didn't go because I wanted to go. I still had about 20 people in jail. Mm-hmm. And that was, that had become the focus of my life, supporting those people and getting those people out of jail. Mm-hmm. And the Panthers ordered me out to California. So I went out to California thinking I was going to get support for the people who were in jail. Three of those people were under double, triple murder charges, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. I had been under murder charges. Attempted murder charges. So it was very personal and very serious, and being ordered out to California to sell newspapers didn't sit well with mm-hmm. me and to collect donations. So I stayed out there for a few months, left the party, felt that I was not in sync with where the party was going. Mm-hmm. So it was amicable in that sense. Okay. You know, it was a time, I came to a place to leave. Mm-hmm. And came back to Baltimore and worked with a lot of ex-Panthers, ex-nationalists, ex-Pan-Africanists, to begin to put together Black Classic Press.
Okay.
It was actually put together as the George Jackson Prison Movement. That's what it was. You know?
Okay. You were known for being a passionate father. And in the book, Ta-Nehisi says that you were often seen with your sons. Or with your children.
My children.
You had
yeah,
your children
course,
with you
course,
often.
Of course.
Why? Or how?
You know, I don't
anything,
know.
Anything you want to say about that. I don't have to explain anything
that,
to me. Because in many ways, I'm the same way. I mean, I'm known for having my kids.
I was going to say, I don't know what to say about that. I think that's a part of fathering. You know what I mean? Like, you're and it's a part of, particularly, again, the thing for me that I constantly go back to is getting particularly boys, getting them across. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's what I would, you know, Ta-Nehisi would say this. You know, I say, like, look, you know, I don't expect you, you know, cold military, mm-hmm. you are not.
That's not you.
You know, like you ain't got to love me. Right. You know what I mean? I'm not here for you to love me. Mm-hmm. I'm not here to be your friend. Mm-hmm. I'm here to be your father and get you across that line. That's why I'm here.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the way it's going to be, you know. So, carrying children and exposing them to the culture, to other people that you consider to be positive, to the experience of being Black that you live in every day, carrying them into the jails. And Ta-Nehisi talks about this when he's 4 years old. Actually, he went into the jail shortly after he was born, a few weeks after he was born. Mm-hmm. That resistance to jail was bred into mm-hmm. him purposely. Mm-hmm. That's why he was taken into the jail. And he writes about that so that he would know the circumstances of the world.
And so
that's
you
what you
never
do with children.
You never want to even act like you want to go there.
No.
Yeah.
No, but also you know how to distinguish, and you know when things work in your interest and when they're not working mm-hmm. in your interest mm-hmm. as well, you know?
You know, I don't want to sidestep what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in today's culture where most of our kids grow up in daycare, number one. So the privilege it is for a child of any age to be able to follow their father around, mm-hmm. number mm-hmm. one. Number two, in a discussion about love, 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 you come forward to say, I'm not here for you to love me. Mm-hmm. I'm here. I am your father. Mm-hmm. And my job is to get you across.
I gotta guide you.
Across that here. Is powerful.
Yeah. The thing that I would say, Nancy, and I used to always say, and said it to all my children, we are love. I mean, we totally love.
Yes,
that's one of the things
yes.
you say and you go in the room and you laugh about
right,
it. You know?
Right.
But the real deal is, like, on the stern face note, you will love your mother. You know?
Right. Yeah.
You
know,
you will love your mother. You will always respect your mother. You will respect me.
Right.
But
right.
I'm not here to be your friend.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, because I'm going to tell you some things, you know, that you know, you're not going to like, but you're going to have to do. You know, it's
sure.
one of those things.
Sure.
And you know, like, Ta-Nehisi, gosh, I don't know, last year sometime we were talking, and I was saying, well, you know, I know you want to hang out with your buds or something like that, or your friends, you know. I said, Dad, wait a minute. You know, you're my father, but you are my friend. Mm.
Right.
You know, you're my friend. And
now that
now
that he's 40.
Talking. Yeah, we kept talking.
And balanced.
But then I had to call him back to that. I said, you know, that was really, really powerful because I never sought to be the friend of
sure.
Fatherhood is, for me, fatherhood has that in it, But that's not, you
it's
know,
not
you
the, gotta it's not the foundation. Yeah. Right.
A friend may not tell you the straight stuff all the time.
Exactly.
You know?
We pay them not to.
And you know, and it's especially not in it when you're raising them.
That's right.
And particularly
right.
when they become teenagers.
That's right.
You know, in reference to your children being
right.
being with you, particularly your sons, as he said, it comes to a point of looking at persuasion them versus influencing them.
Mm-hmm.
And when you
mm-hmm.
know that they're with you and they see what you're doing and they yeah. see how you interact and they see how to carry themselves when they walk into the barber shop, that's
right.
an influence.
That's right.
You know, the thing with the scrap, that's a persuasion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very effective one.
Ta-Nehisi called you an enlightened despot. Yeah, that got a lad for me,
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
that
yeah,
really
yeah,
had
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that he was probably looking at that now from 40 looking back or from
yeah.
whatever period. At the time, it would have just been a despot, you know? But looking back, he was able to see. And, you know, looking back, it's different. You're across the line now.
Yeah.
Not, you know, not even talking about his success. That's not the line.
Yeah,
right.
I get it.
The line is getting to a point in manhood where you can make reasonable, sensible choices, where you can look back at your family and understand that you have responsibilities to bring them up. That's
mm-hmm.
the line,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I think he was on the other side of the line when he was looking at that, you know, enlightened despot.
I'm going to throw a few names at you, and I'd like to get a sentence or two, a comment on each of them. So here we go. Dr. Clark.
John Henry Clark was a mentor and a father figure for me.
Yeah.
Many of the early books we published were because John Henry Clark would say, you know, like, you need to bring this book back. You
mm-hmm.
need. He never said it about his books, although
uh-huh.
we were able to bring a couple. As a matter of fact, his one book, Marcus Garvey, and the Vision of Africa is one of the most influential books on me,
mm-hmm.
Which was one of his books, and it's some of his best writing.
Mm-hmm.
He never said that. We agreed to do that much later. But he and brothers like John G. Jackson
mm-hmm.
Were the old brothers who knew the books, who knew the history and knew the importance of those books being back, the very obscure histories. John G. Jackson used to give me books that I'd have to I'd have to go through something to find those books, but he knew those books.
Mm-hmm,
those
mm-hmm.
books, I mean, this man is 80 going on 90 years old.
Yeah.
Those books are traveling up in his brain,
yeah.
and he's passing them off to someone who is younger,
mm-hmm.
who has the responsibility to pass them off
mm-hmm.
to people who come behind.
Mm-hmm.
These were great men.
It's when I say Dr. Clark, I almost said Dr. Clark on purpose without saying Dr. John Henry Clark, because that is in the black community. You can say Dr. Clark, and everybody knows who you're talking about. It's just that simple. All right, here's another one, Dr. Ben.
Dr. Ben gave Ta-Nehisi his name, actually.
Wow.
I don't know if you know that. But Dr. Ben, who had known since the early 70s, this was when we set up the bookstore, and I became familiar with Dr. Ben. He called right as the day that Ta-Nehisi actually was born. I had talked with him a couple weeks before and told him I needed help with a name.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, he never called me that much. He just never called me that much. That day he called.
Mm.
And I told him I was in between going to the hospital, and I had narrowed down the names. And, you know, from his work,
mm-hmm.
I had pulled out two names. And one was Tom Maori. And the other one was Ta-Nehisi. He said, name him Ta-Nehisi. He will need a strong name.
Mm.
And that's what he gave him. So I went to the hospital and gave it to Charles, and that was it.
There was a little bit of a Dr. Ben impression in there, too.
Yeah.
And I got it.
Yeah.
JFK.
Yeah. Well, no, that wasn't the Dr. Ben impression. The Dr. Ben impression is, Brother Kurtz, I tell you something that my father told me. What is that, Dr. Ben? Never get old.
You know, one of the things I can appreciate that Dr. Ben said, Dr. Ben had an appreciation for women.
Mm.
All the time.
He really
All
did.
He really did.
All the time.
He was going to worship something.
All the time.
That was it.
All the time.
JFK.
See, I don't have a lot about JFK. That's been pretty much whatever I had as a child. It's been wiped out by all of the memories. I mean, all those memories have been wiped out by the realities mm-hmm. that I've learned mm-hmm. about JFK, that I've learned about his administration, that mm-hmm. I've learned really about the government in opposition to black people actually seeking their rights. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have a lot of memories there.
Walter Mosley.
Walter is someone I just finished talking to a few minutes ago. He's just a wonderful, wonderful, powerful, creative genius of a man.
Absolutely.
I introduced him. I don't know if you know this, but he was named the Grand Master of the Mystery Writers of America.
Mm-hmm.
And
nice.
That's a distinct honor. He's the first African-American. That award has been around for 70 years. He's the first and the only one.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked me to introduce him to the crowd. And you know, Walter is not the first black mystery writer. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a long tradition of mystery writers. But I did introduce him to the crowd about 2 weeks ago, actually. And that was a singular honor. I have the distinction of being able to read Walter Mosley pieces. Quite often when he finishes them, he'll mm-hmm. send them to me. Mm-hmm. I have the honor of reading Ta-Nehisi pieces, not often when he finishes them, mm-hmm. okay? I usually get them a little bit later, but which carries me back. I do want to clear up one thing. I've never collaborated with Ta-Nehisi on any of his writing. He has given me on both of the books and on some other stuff, he's given me the honor of critiquing it,
mm-hmm.
you know, when it was in editorial stages or something like that. It's not good to be a father and critiquing.
Right.
Let me just say that.
About you.
Because you want more. You want more. It's just like when they used to do school papers. And then you get back and you say, gosh, damn, that was hard. You know?
What I was thinking about when I said you collaborated with him was there was, when I listened to the most recent book,
yes.
At the end they say you have rights to, your company has rights or something like that, copyright to the audio.
It may have been images or something like that. I'm not really sure on that because I haven't heard the audio.
Uh-huh.
But I've never collaborated with him. I've always talked with him mm-hmm. during any major mm-hmm. writing project.
Okay.
I've talked with him, but he,
he
does his own mm-hmm. thing, and particularly in this last case, he and Chris Jackson, a brilliant, brilliant brother up in New York. They're the ones that really worked closely on this last book.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Walter Mosley, back to Walter Mosley for a second. I want to plug him myself. There's a series that he does by a PI mm-hmm. by the name of Leonard McGill.
Yes.
I love that. Yeah, I mean, mind you, I've listened and read a lot of Easy Rawlins stuff.
Sure.
Of course, saw the movie.
Sure.
I'm familiar with Socrates Fortlow.
Yes, you are. You're a Walter Mosley guy.
Yeah, Fearless Jones. However, this Leonard McGill, I mean, it's something really powerful about this character. And one of the things that comes to mind, there's a issue that comes up between him and his wife. And they both have other relationships. They've both been in other relationships over the course of their marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And This one of the guys that the wife is seeing decides that he wants to basically harm her because he doesn't like that they're about to break up or something like that. Something of, mm-hmm. to that effect. Mm-hmm. Do something to besmirch her. And so he sends sends pictures mm-hmm. to Leonid, the
mm-hmm.
husband.
Mm-hmm.
And Leonid gets the pictures and they don't say who they're from. They're just pictures. He gets the pictures. He deciphers who sent the pictures. And he goes to this guy and basically says, you ever threaten my wife or you do anything that, you know, that going to cause a problem for my wife, and it will be me and you. Mm-hmm. And that's such a different perspective than most people want to give a dynamic like that. So many people want to, you get pictures of your wife doing whatever,
right,
and you go off on your wife. Nah, he said, I'm going off on you. That's my wife.
Right.
I'm going to protect her. Mm-hmm. So that was that's a interesting story in a fascinating series. And kudos to Walter Mosley.
Let me just ride on that just for one moment, since you know this is about Frank Love. Mm-hmm. You know, that is an approach that women take in other cultures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've experienced some cultures where the woman will tell you, I'm not worried about my man. He's a man. It's that other woman that I got to keep an eye on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what that brings to mind when you talk about that approach.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. James Baldwin.
Seminal. I mean, just untouchable. Mm. I wish I had I had many, many opportunities to develop relationships with Baldwin and did not do it. Mm-hmm. Chose to, you know, lay back and observe from a distance more.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't say I wish. There is a space that could have been taken advantage of, so that I would have even more memories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tupac Shakur.
I think about his sister. I think about Setua. Afeni just died, as you know. And I think about, you talk about soft, his sister was soft. And I think about, when I talk about starting a press in Baltimore, the person who actually was instrumental in Tupac launching into a rapper was a sister in Baltimore who worked with young kids.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to take Tupac down to the YWCA. That same sister was one of the people. I needed $300 to buy a press in order to start Black Classic Press. A brother gave me $200. I just talked with him. I didn't ask him for the money. But I said, there's a press out there. I need $300 to do it. Brother immediately came forward and said, Paul, I've got $200.
Mm-hmm.
Sister came forward and said, Paul, I got $100. That was a sister who helped bring Tupac along, right?
Wow.
But I think about that. She died. She was one of the early victims of AIDS. And so she died a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Tupac ends up going to the West Coast with Afeni. But I think about Satra, who I hadn't talked to in a long time and had a chance to talk to last week, who's healthy.
Great.
And who's well in spite of her mother dying recently, you know.
Very nice.
Mm-hmm.
J.A. Rogers.
Rogers I've never met, but I've always admired his work. His wife I knew, and his wife I used to interact with. Rogers was a person who, like so many other committed researchers of Black history, had been told at an early age that Black people had no history.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Had no history. Mm-hmm. And you probably know this, he grew up with Marcus Garvey. Mm-hmm. They grew up as boys,
wow,
you know, in Jamaica together. And they would come together in New York much later, and he would write for the Negro World. Garvey in his greatness, and Rogers in his greatness. Rogers has left us great inquiries,
mm-hmm,
great inquiries, not into so much Black ancestry, but more into white ancestry,
mm-hmm,
and what that actually means, since Rogers' research dealt with race mixing,
right,
you know, and how the staunchest of white lines, you know, were influenced by Black lines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much Black blood was in the white race.
Mm-hmm.
That was fascinating to him, you know, and intriguing. And he left such a great body of work there, you know. But, you know, truly a great writer.
We're talking with father, husband, and founder of Black Classic Press, a company devoted to publishing obscure and significant works by and about people of African descent. He's also the founder of BCP Digital Printing, which produces books and documents using digital print technologies. He's also the patriarch in the memoir by Ta-Nehisi Coates, The Beautiful Struggle. He is Paul Coates. Brother Coates, please tell us what you're up to and how listeners can find your publications and procure your printing services.
Sure. People can find us on the web, Black Classic Press. I'm sorry, blackclassicbooks.com. That's the website for Black Classic Press, and that's the best place to deal with it. That's blackclassicbooks.com. Our printing comes under BCP Digital Printing, and that's bcpdigitalprinting.com.
Okay.
BCP. And the BCP, that's Black Classic Press. Digital Printing.
They're not unrelated.
Yeah, they're not. They're not. They're not. Or they can type in, you know, Black Classic to the web or Paul Coates to the web. Mm-hmm. And we're based in Baltimore. We're a company that's based in Baltimore, have been in Baltimore for the last 38, 39 years.
Wow.
A family-owned company with deep, deep roots in our community.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You were in a polygamous relationship for some time.
I don't know about polygamous.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know about polygamous. I don't know about polygamous, you know. you know, there's a... There seems to be like almost a permissiveness or something like that with polygamy. I don't know. I've always been someone who believed in multiple relationships, okay? And as someone who believed in multiple relationships, I engaged in multiple relationships most of my life and was never monogamous until most recently. Mm-hmm. I remarried in 2008 and have been happily monogamous. Mm-hmm. So in multiple relationships, since you opened that door, in multiple relationships, look, I love the idea of multiple relationships. I don't know about polygamy because polygamy is not, polygamy is the relationship of the man having multiple wives, you see, and I'm not really hung up on that. You know, I think, you know, people should have the opportunity to experience life as they see it. So if that means women having multiple husbands, or if that was their choice, that's their choice. And if it works in a societal way in which society can support it, then I'm in favor of that. My engagement in multiple relationships, Brother Frank, I have to tell you, In all seriousness, in the end, did not work. It did not work. And it took me years, I mean, years to understand that the sisters I engaged with understood it.
That it didn't work?
That it didn't work. They understood it didn't work. I didn't understand that it didn't work. You know, I didn't understand it didn't work until I was talking with this sister one day, and this was after my last marriage, and I was in between marriages, and we were talking about getting together, and so, you know, you have to give up a history, you know, you have to say what you've done, et cetera, et cetera. So she gave up her history in about
10 minutes.
Okay. I mean, you know, I mean, it was like three relationships or something like that. I went on and on and on and on.
She said, "All right, well, let's pick up tomorrow morning."
She said it must have been, you know, at the end of it. She said two things. She said, "Oh, that makes me sick." You know. I mean, she was like that, you know. But the thing that she said it must have been hard.
Yeah.
I thought she was talking about sex. That's how far away I was from it. And I said, "No, it wasn't hard. You know, you just have to, you know, allot your time, you know, and things like." I thought that's what she was talking, because that's the way brothers tend to listen to sisters, you know. It took me about 3 days, and I was going over her conversation, and she said it must have been hard. It must have been hard. That was rolling in my brain, and it occurred to me what she was talking about. She was talking about the pain. She was talking about the pain that went on. And it occurred to me that it was hard, that my life in multiple relationships had been hard, that I had never satisfied anyone, that never satisfied myself. Don't get this like I'm against multiple relationships. I am absolutely in favor mm-hmm. of multiple relationships, and I believe people should have that choice. Looking at my life, the way I had lived it, it had not worked, mm-hmm. okay? And it didn't work for me, and so I was at the end of the road. I said, okay, that didn't work, mm-hmm. you know? I did not have, and I don't think in this country there are enough, at least in the Black community, enough supports. There are enough institutions. There's enough guidance available at this time mm-hmm. to make that work on a mass scale. Mm-hmm. Should it be there? I think people should have those options, mm-hmm. you know, because I think families come all different stripes, all different ways, and all of this pretense about you know, one man, one woman, that don't work. We all right. know what
there
the
are a bunch
is.
Of things that yeah. don't work. It's not yeah. just multiple
that's
relationships.
Right. That's
though.
Right. That's right. right.
Didn't
so
work.
If we were honest about mm-hmm. it, you know, those don't work either. Mm-hmm. But that was my decision. That was a personal decision for me looking backwards. And I don't recommend I'm not saying I don't recommend not doing it. That's right. Yeah. That's right. I don't okay. recommend people take my decision as script mm-hmm. or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's like at the line. Who knows? I got a few more years left in me.
You know what
I mean? But it's not a commitment. Whereas when I was young, it was a commitment. You know, that I came out of the Panther Party. Not only was it a commitment, it was a political
statement.
Understanding
yes.
in mm-hmm. coming out of the Panther Party. The whole idea of one man owning a woman, mm-hmm. one woman owning a man, mm-hmm. no, that was a anti-family structure right. to be in. And so coming into an African-centered community, that wasn't necessary either, mm-hmm. you know? So it's been an evolution for me, but it's a personal decision that fits me at this time. I'm the happiest I ever been in my life. I make mm-hmm. my wife happy, mm-hmm. you know. She engages with me. We're very, very happy like this. Mm-hmm. But other mm-hmm. folks can find it different ways.
To interject a little bit of a personal story with Brother Coates, I went to him years ago. I was looking to my company was doing some things in Baltimore, and I was looking for a way to set up shop in Baltimore. And he got on the phone and called this sister, and he said, "Hey, honey, I got someone here who needs some help, and you know, dot dot dot. This is what do you think?" And lo and behold, he's talking in a very loving manner, and I go and meet this sister, and this is his former wife, and he handed me right off to her. She was able to in some way profit from our relationship, you know, from the relationship she and I created, and it was a seamless handoff from him to her in what appeared to be a very loving relationship, a very good relationship. So, I mean, I have witnessed the evolution of whatever it is you guys created from your marriage, from your children. And I've also seen him, and I talked to my dad, and he says that him, like you, they just love their wives. I mean, it's just like they just are just
nice.
Giddy almost.
mm-hmm.
So
nice,
to watch these men who are now, you know, pushing 70, who were hardcore and even
right.
hardcore with women.
Right.
That's not bad. I'm not saying that's
not
a
abusive,
bad thing. Yeah, yes,
serious.
Just hardcore mm-hmm. in terms of philosophies
sure.
and that sort of thing. Hard edges, to watch them be, you know,
putty in their hands.
right, it rubs off on me. Mm. It really does, because that's the previous generation. It's going to rub off on you,
mm-hmm. right?
And just to be clear, that was Ta-Nehisi's mother, okay, and that mm-hmm. would have been Cheryl Waters, someone who I still love.
Mm-hmm.
Someone, you know, just to add perspective to this, when I got ready to be married, I told my now wife that I would have to, that what was there for me mm-hmm. was to ask Charles' permission
mm. wow.
to marry.
Mm. Wow.
Okay. Charles and I didn't have a relationship. We hadn't had a relationship, any type of intimate relationship in probably 8 or 9 years by that time.
Mm-hmm. And she has since remarried also.
She has since remarried, yes. Mm-hmm. In which she didn't ask me permission, but I actually told her the brother to marry.
Wow.
You know, it's like I said, no, Cheryl, that's the one.
That's the one. Yeah.
Do that. I asked him into our family. Mm-hmm. Okay, I asked him into our family.
God, that's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
He's
awesome.
Our family.
Isn't that awesome?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
That's a beautiful circle.
Yeah. Yes, it
so,
is.
So it was very important that she's my friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, she's my friend, and it's it would be unbalanced for me to enter into a marriage and be happy in that marriage, and she be on the outside
yes.
and not be happy.
Yes.
So the thing to do was to ask her permission,
mm-hmm.
and she. She loves my wife. Mm-hmm. She always has loved my wife, you know, and I love her husband. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, again, I asked him into our family, and I'm so glad. He's a wonderful, wonderful grandfather to our grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
He's a wonderful brother to me, and just to add another note, he's also a bookseller. Okay. So.
What a collaboration.
The money in the family.
Come on into the family.
Right.
We need the bookseller part. We got the publisher. We got the writer. We got the publisher.
We need
that was divine sense.
Common you, sense and divine sense.
You have another son with Sister Waters, Menelik. You have children. And one of the things the book touches on is how you were able to welcome all of your children into the home that you shared with Sister Waters. And it's clear that that was important to her, that she and you be parents, you know, that you all co-parent all of the children mm-hmm. that you had from previous relationships in that household.
No, that's correct. And to be clear again, in my most recent marriage, I acquired two more children.
So
our family's even larger. Mm-hmm. Okay, two more young men mm-hmm. who have helped cross the line into manhood, and they're beautiful men.
Mm-hmm.
They're beautiful men. But here's the thing: there are four mothers to my birth children, mm-hmm. four mothers. Mm-hmm. We get together frequently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get together for weddings, we get together for funerals, we get together for everything. There's no stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, largely it's no stuff because there was a lot of integrity throughout mm-hmm. in the relationships.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't stuff before.
Mm-hmm.
No relationship I ever got into was things hidden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that, you know, and it wasn't like the woman doing something to another woman.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You mm-hmm. know, I take responsibility for whatever it was, and there was always going to be a conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, you always have the option. You know.
Right.
That if this doesn't work, you know, and folks did do that. There's this opportunity for honesty, and this is why I was distinguishing, trying to get away from polygamy, and much more toward polygyny.
Uh-huh.
You know, much more mm-hmm. toward polygyny, where there is an opportunity for
either everybody.
Way, and, mm-hmm. and people have an opportunity to respond in their way.
Mm-hmm.
But honesty.
Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. I get it. The you weren't painted as the father on the Cosby Show, and we're talking about before the legal troubles and all
yeah.
of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How did it feel to experience Ta-Nehisi's digestion of you on paper, even if it's as a 5-year-old, 10, how did that feel?
He's a tremendous writer. Mm-hmm. He's a tremendous writer, and I felt that he captured his father, and still feel he captures his father very well. Even when, I read things that people talk about abuse and things like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
He and I talk about it sometimes. Sometimes I'm disturbed about it, and sometimes he actually expresses regret. But
of what?
Regret for writing about that part of his development, because and I have to tell him everything that he ever wrote, everything I've ever seen him write about me and coming, I felt he captured it perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
It's how some people walk away from it.
Right.
You walked away from it with the love and all that stuff that you got because you have a context for it.
Yes.
Someone else who has no context for it sees it a different way. Mm-hmm. But that's not his writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not his writing. His writing captures, I think, the whole situation and the whole upbringing, I think, perfectly. I think he's just so spot on, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. One of the characters in the book is your son,
yes.
Bill.
Yes.
He's Ta-Nehisi's elder brother.
That's correct.
And it was he was more of what some would consider a knucklehead. Mm-hmm. And I guess harder in terms of his presentation to the world than Ta-Nehisi.
Yes.
What were your thoughts about Bill being a gun-toting young man, if you even knew?
I did not know at the time. I would have killed him at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I literally, I'd have gone to jail for that one.
Wow.
You know? I mean, that's that thing again. You know what I mean? You know, you would dare?
Right.
You know, no.
Did you confront him once you learned?
I didn't. Oh no, he's a grown man.
Too far along.
Right.
Yeah,
he's a grown man.
Right.
And literally, I mean, he's my business partner now.
Got it.
But there's not you can't have a conversation about something that happened 25 years ago, knowing that he was a young boy coming along. And he was doing what young boys did
and
at
knowing
that time.
Who,
and knowing that's not who he is now.
Exactly. Knowing
okay.
who
you
he is now.
Saying?
Yeah.
So it's not something you could. We've never had a conversation. There's no point.
Right.
I don't even know what I would say. Oh, you. I don't know what I would. It's two different time spaces, you know? Like now, it's something that happened in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Then it would have been something that was happening then.
Right.
And so it would have been a violation. It would have been an impediment to getting him across the line. He's over the line now.
Okay.
You
okay.
see. So looking back on it, it's like being in two different spaces. You know.
And you know, also along with that, when you look back on it, you know, and he knew that it was something that was not permitted.
That's right.
And that's why he kept it undercover.
That's right.
You know. So you know, it has the reward that you know. Well, he knew he was wrong. Thank God he got through it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you could go back, or if you, and just looking back, anything you would change? And that's such a wide question. I mean, anything about anything that you would change?
I don't know, you know, and this is one of the things that I tell, I still tell my children because they have children,
mm-hmm.
you know? Like, you. I mean, in my life, there are probably things to change, sure. I mean, you know, if I go back, maybe I would not do this. Maybe I would spend more time with my mother, mm-hmm. you know, who has departed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I would have sought my father out, who after we were nine, I didn't see him anymore, but knew generally where he was, mm-hmm. you know. Maybe I would have done that. I don't know, you know. But in terms of children, I have like a firm policy on that, you know.
Other than they got to get out at 18.
No, that's it. They got to go at 18. They got to go at 18. So I have a firm policy on that, and that really is like you got to just in the moment do the best you can do,
mm-hmm.
you know, and really make a decision in that moment that you're doing the best that you can do, so that you don't have things years later that you look back on and say, I wish I had done it this way. I wish I had. Mm-hmm. See, if you're doing the best you can do in that moment, then there's nothing else you can do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you can always look back and say, well, it could have been done differently. But if in that moment you really have invested your time, your energy, your thought, and you tried to do the very best that you could do, there's no regrets.
Mm-hmm.
There's no regrets. So I don't, in terms of my kids, I have kids that talk about how they didn't get name brand tennis shoes and how the shoes they got fell apart and stuff like that.
And these are conversations you guys are having
years
these days.
Later.
they are having.
I have kids that talk about how they didn't get cars when they were 16 and other people got cars. No regrets.
Right.
Mm.
Beautiful.
No regrets.
Any real? I guess this is real quick. Any advice to husbands?
Same advice to wives, you know, like honesty, you know, I mean, like, you know, like really, really, really bring that as a living dynamic into our lives, you know, honesty.
Any advice to young males?
Honesty.
Fathers.
honesty, you know.
Mothers of
honesty,
young males.
Honesty. I mean, you know, really, it's like such a, you know, some people call it integrity, you know, and like everything rests on that foundation, like just being honest to kids. When Ta-Nehisi talks about later, he grew up in a hard house. Mm-hmm. He says that he grew up in a hard house with love. That's honesty. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes, you know, like what I'm going to tell you, I'm trying to tell you the best I can tell you. It may not come out right. Mm-hmm. It may not sound right, but it's as honest as I can make it. And it's really, the intent is so that we have a foundation going forward.
Mm-hmm. And what would you expect me to do? Say nothing? Mm-hmm. Even though I'm not, even if the idea or the concept isn't fully articulated, you want me to say nothing?
Honestly.
No, I got to give you what I got right now.
Honesty and integrity.
Yeah. We've been talking with father, husband, and founder of Black Classic Press, a company devoted to publishing obscure...
And grandfather.
And grandfather. excuse me.
Watch yourself.
A company devoted to publishing obscure and significant works by and about people of African descent. He's also the founder of BCP Digital Printing, which produces books and documents using digital print technology. And he's also the patriarch in the memoir by Ta-Nehisi Coates, The Beautiful Struggle. He's Paul Coates. So, Brother Coates, last time, please tell our listeners what you're up to and how they can find you and your publications and your services, your printing services.
Yeah, at the heart of what I'm up to is always building a legacy that serves, I mean, it's the highest goal that I have, building a legacy that serves our community, that serves those who are coming. We work in Baltimore under the name of Black Classic Press, and people can find us at blackclassicbooks.com or bcpdigitalprinting.com.
Along today's journey, we've discussed fatherhood, the Black Panthers. I can really create a list here. Mm-hmm. Honesty and integrity, publishing, printing, grandfatherhood,
polygyny,
multiple relationships. Whoa, okay. I hope you've learned as much as I had talking with Paul Coates about all of the aforementioned. As always, it's my wish for you to walk away from this conversation with a heaping helping of useful information that'll help you create a relationship that's as loving and accepting as possible. Let us know what you thought of today's show at Facebook.com/RelationshipFLove, on Twitter at Mr. That's M-R Frank Love, or at franklove.com. If you're listening via Blog Talk Radio, make sure you like us there. And if via iTunes, make sure you subscribe so that you can receive each week's show. This is Frank Love.